This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and we have with us tonight Cassandra Veeton with Noetic Sciences, and we're going to talk about the new book she and Marilyn Schlitz wrote, Living Deeply. How are you, Cassie?
I'm doing well.
So before we get started, just give us a little background about you and how this book came to be. And
sure. Well, first of all, let me just say that there were three authors. So it's Marilyn Schlitz and myself and Tina Amarok. And I am a clinical psychologist who was in training to become a psychotherapist when I decided that I also wanted to get some research training at the same time, and so trained in doing research at the University of California, San Francisco, and focused primarily on research on addictions there. So one track I was in a program that was looking at how to help people change their lives psychotherapeutically, with a very strong emphasis on integrating Eastern philosophies and indigenous wisdom. That was the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. And then at the same time was receiving very good research training, looking into, at that point, addictions, and found in the Institute of Noetic Sciences a place where I could marry those two interests, one in science and one in spirituality and well-being.
Interesting. Noetic Sciences, I just have so much respect for what they do. They've really brought out a lot of information that's really helped a lot of people. So I applaud what you guys do.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about how this book got started and what the basis of it is.
Well, this is actually based on a decade-long program of research that started at the Institute of Noetic Sciences before I got there. It was about, I guess, 12 years ago now that there was a businessman who was definitely not kind of what you'd think of as a New Age character. He was a very pragmatic, down to business kind of guy, very successful. And he had an experience of his own transformation, and it's described in the book. He wrote the preface to the book. His name was Dick Gunther. And he was somehow invited to a seminar at Esalen, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, on the Big Sur coastline in California, and a place where lots of transformative education takes place, and found himself out on the deck of the seminar and looked out over the ocean and saw the light coming in through the trees, the sunshine and the seals at play and the seagulls overhead and the trees and mountains behind him, and had an experience of feeling not separate from anything he was seeing and feeling a sense of oneness with everything and sort of a deep recognition that he was made of the same stuff as everything he could see in this beautiful landscape. And it was a deep knowing, much like the kind of experience that started the Institute of Noetic Sciences, where Edgar Mitchell had a similar experience after his Apollo 14 walk on the moon, where he was returning to Earth and had the window seat and looked down upon the Earth as he was returning and had a very similar experience of oneness and seeing the Earth from space and seeing it for the beautiful jewel that it is, and a deep sense of also sadness and pain about the unnecessary suffering and cruelty and separation, and really seeing very clearly that the difficulties among people on the planet had as much to do with limited consciousness as anything else. And so he came back to Earth with a strong dedication to bringing together the science that he had been trained as an engineer at MIT and as an astronaut and a pilot with this deep subjective inner knowing that he later came to call a samadhi experience. And so this work started when Dick Gunther came to the Institute and told, at that time, Marilyn Schliss about his experience and said, you know, this is, and it's something that really improved his life. It really changed his life for the positive, and he's since become someone who is well known for his altruism, and, you know, was one of the people who was involved in a large amount of microloans to people in third world countries, and so every day changing people's lives for the better. Mm-hmm. So his whole life became oriented around compassion and love and doing positive things in the world. And so he wanted to find out what happened to him, and if he thought, you know, maybe if we can find out more about it, we can help it happen for other people. And so at the time, Marilyn started a study, and I think at the time she was working with Moira Kelly and Rhea White, and she put out a call to the Noetic Sciences membership for stories of their own personal transformations, and hundreds of people sent in their stories, and they did a qualitative analysis of those stories to see if they were just completely different and idiosyncratic to each person, or whether there were some commonalities that they could begin to find. And in fact, they did find some commonalities among people's experiences, whether it was a Vietnam veteran having an experience on the battlefield, or a mother of kids, or all kinds of different seemingly very disparate experiences, all had a sense of, for example, it being a defining turning point in their life, and really looking at their life as here was the time before and here was the time after, and also sort of a hero's journey template for that kind of experience. So after that, they convened a series of focus groups with teachers of transformative practices in the Bay Area. There's lots of different transformative practices happening out here in San Francisco. So brought people together from a variety of different practices and religions and spiritual traditions. And again, we're sort of looking at, is there some common ground here in this process of transformation across different traditions? And found in those focus groups enough commonality to then embark on a more in-depth study, and that's when I came on board, and we designed a study where we did in-depth interviews with 60 masters and teachers from a variety of the world's religious, spiritual, and modern eclectic transformative traditions, as well as scholars who had studied transformation. And each interview took 2 hours, and they were all videotaped, and we had 2 independent coders rate each video and code each one line by line, and left us with a database of about 20,000 lines of data, and sorted all of that into common themes that appeared across these interviews. And that's what forms the basis of the book Living Deeply, The Art and Science of Transformation in Everyday Life.
Well, I have to say, I went through this book with a red pen, and I had one of those experiences, so I know exactly what you're talking about. And it really does hit the nail on the head in some of the places. For example, you talk about you suddenly get actual states of knowledge where you know. You know. And it's due to circumstances completely out of your control. It just happens. You can't stop it. You can't make it happen. It just happens. And you know it as well as you know your name.
Right.
So it's an important book to at least help people understand what's available to them if they walk towards that or seek that path. So,
yeah, and you know what we have found in our own research and what we're finding from large surveys like the General Social Survey and Gallup polls is that many, many people have experienced something transformative like that, something that they feel changed their life. I think it was a recent Gallup poll or General Social Survey that said something around 70% of people answered yes to the question, have you had a religious or spiritual experience that changed your life? So these are pretty common. They're very rare, however, in the psychological and medical literature, so very little attention had been paid to this phenomenon prior to about 10 years ago, and now there are a number of groups looking at how people have these seemingly spontaneous transformations where deep and profound and long-lasting changes in their worldview, and you might even say in their personality, which was previously mm-hmm. thought to be kind of impossible, happen. And so I think it's a very exciting time to look at this. And then it also opens the door to looking at the kinds of factors that are involved in the integration of these kinds of realizations and experiences, because we all know that it doesn't, in some ways it happens in a moment, and in most ways it doesn't happen in a moment. It's all of the integration afterward of that realization. We had one interviewee who said, you know, yes, you absolutely transform in a moment, but then you spend the rest of your life living into that transformation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you find that anyone ever wants to go back, or even feels like they could go back if they wanted to?
Well, certainly we have talked to people, both teachers and individuals who have had their own transformative experiences that have something like the dark night of the soul, where there's a period of disorientation, there's a period of everything that was previously held as sort of true and safe and certain gets thrown up into the air. And yeah, I mean, if you refer to the movie The Matrix, there are certainly people, I think, who say, I wish I would have taken the blue pill. But I think that that is probably a natural part of the transformative journey. You know, why, at some moments, we probably all asked ourselves, why do I even want to be more awake? Can't I just sort of numb out for a little while? And
but you can't take it away, though, can you?
No, I mean, I think there's some really interesting differences between experiences that are extraordinary or remarkable and experiences that are truly transformative. And it seems like once you've seen something, you can't unsee it again,
right.
No
it's
matter
kind of
how
like
hard you try.
Learning how to ride a bicycle, you can't forget how to do it.
Yeah.
You know. So tell me, do you find some commonalities about what precedes the spontaneous, I call it waking up, I don't know what else to call it.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the words that, one of the phrases that a lot of our folks would have used is waking up. And, you know, the most common precipitant of an awakening and experience is pain and suffering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's having that kind of deconstruction that I talked about earlier, where you lose a loved one, you have a brush with death, you have a life-threatening illness. You know, you lose a career, you get into a place of transition, and those seem to be by far the most common precipitants of a transformative experience. Now, there are people for whom, who do have transformative experiences that don't have that happening, where they have a moment of awe or wonder or extreme bliss or oneness, like these experiences that I mentioned earlier with Dick Gunther and Edgar Mitchell. So I think that that's possible as well. But regardless of what precipitates it, the kind of transformation we were looking at was what you might call a positive transformation or a life-affirming transformation. So there are certainly moments where people have negative changes as well, but what we were really looking at was what is the phenomenon of these intensely positive changes that people report, and when they look back on them, so many people say it happened at a time, it happened, you know, after my divorce, it happened after I had cancer, it happened, you know, when someone very close to me died, or when I lost my career or had financial crisis.
One thing that I've always heard other masters say is that you can usually tell if you're in the midst of a dark night of the soul, if you'll pay attention, that things like that, there are about 10 things. Sicknesses come and go, relationships fall apart. And if you can recognize it in the midst of it, because they tend to come back a couple of years later, almost like it's a test, can you find it again?
Mm-hmm.
So that you can stop the misery if you just remember.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that?
Well, yeah, we definitely had people say things like that, you know, where in some ways it is a remembrance. It's something, it doesn't seem when people experience these, say this experience of oneness, or there are other ways that people describe it, but people talk about it as something that has always been there. It's just now that they're noticing it or recognizing it or remembering it. And I think that's a really fascinating process, that it doesn't feel like a new piece of information or a new learning. It's more like a veil has been lifted.
So do you find, how do people, and do you find something similar in the way that people are accepted by the people around them that haven't had the experience?
Well, I mean, you know, there
Breaking
are
up
some...
A little bit. Are you away from your base?
Yeah. Well, there are some factors that appear to kind of differentiate between the these big life-shattering experiences that end up being transformative and the ones that end up just being traumatic and end up in more fear and more constriction and a lot of, you know, depression, anxiety. And one of the differences is that people who are able to transform often have some sort of supportive or like-minded community, or they find one, they're forced to find one, because it's very difficult to go back into a community that doesn't believe in, you know, any of this hocus-pocus kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, you tell them about your experience, and they don't really have a, there is no common ground where you can talk to them. There isn't a common language or a context or a cosmology. And it can be very alienating and leave you very lonely, I think.
Yes, it can.
And I think that, you know, it's very difficult to maintain or to integrate any kind of transformation when the environment is not conducive to it taking root.
All right,
and,
you're breaking
yeah.
up. Can you go closer to your phone base?
Yeah. Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
What advice do you have for the mental health care practitioner, because a lot of times it sounds like the person has, once this has happened, and the person doesn't understand it yet, it can sound like they have a mental illness. They start saying, you know, they hear things, you know, they hear voices. And really it's, you know, it's information or consciousness or God or something. What advice can you give the practitioner for helping their patients who are experiencing this?
Well, I think the first thing that all mental health practitioners can do is to bring themselves up to at least a minimal level of competency around spiritual issues. And what I mean by that is that there has been quite a long time where now cultural competency has been a required skill for psychotherapists. It's been a required part of the training. Gender competency was another competency that all therapists were expected to have at this point and at one point weren't. And now I'm involved in a group of people called the Institute for Spirituality and Psychology who is trying to establish a set of spiritual competencies so that it's not that each practitioner has to know about every spiritual path because that would be impossible, but they do need to know that there is the possibility that something that looks a lot like a breakdown or a hallucination can actually be what one can call a spiritual emergence, and that there are some differentiating factors that can help you differentially diagnose between someone who's having a maladaptive breakdown and someone who's having an adaptive breakthrough, even though the symptoms can look kind of similar sometimes. And one of those is very simply just to say that when it's an adaptive breakthrough or a spiritual emergence, it is typically something that is beneficial and positive. People talk about experiences of connectedness or oneness or psychic phenomena or I saw a blue pearl or, you know, something like that. And often it's not persecutory, it's not paranoid, it's not life detracting, it's life affirming. And so that's one of the big differentials there. And the other is to just know when it's time to refer to someone or to collaborate with someone who is spiritually or theologically skilled so that if someone is having experiences of Jesus, for example, and they are Christian or used to be Christian, it's a great idea to get their pastor or their minister or one that you trust who's progressive to come in and collaborate with you on this case so that you're honoring that the spiritual life can emerge into consciousness in ways that are pretty disturbing and disorienting at times.
Now, what would you suggest? Because I talked to someone the other day that was talking about the problems with, and I didn't expect to go into this with you, but now that I know your background, I want to ask you about this. The problem with the diagnostic codes. How would a therapist code this so that they can get paid for it?
Well, that is very tricky. And I work with a man named David Lukoff, who is someone who has done a lot of work. He worked on the DSM-4, the most recent manual for diagnosis for psychologists. And he tried very hard to get there to be a code for this kind of spiritual emergency that we're talking about. And he was able to get it into what they call the V codes, which are sort of like, I don't know, it's like your other category, right? Mm-hmm. And there is a V code called religious and spiritual problems. And that is something that doesn't mean that religion or spirituality is a problem. It just means that rather than being called psychosis or depression or anxiety necessarily, you can code for the V code. Now, there are a lot of places that don't pay for V codes, but you can at least link it to dysthymia or some other way that the symptoms are manifesting and, you know, have that documented. And I think there's still some work underway to try to get it to be an actual code. The other thing is we don't want to pathologize religious or spiritual problems because almost everyone has them at one point or another in their life. It's part of the natural process. And so, yeah, it'd be great to be able to have people supported to find help when those things are happening, because I think if one is shepherded through in a way that makes sense, it can make the difference between it becoming a lifelong problem or a maladaptive thing and something that was a transformative experience.
Well, I can tell you, when it happened to me, I was diagnosed as being psychotic,
mm-hmm.
and that I was bipolar, and I had racing thoughts, and they put me on all these medications, and, you know, it was awful, and, and you know, I went through, it caused me to have divorce, and so then I go to the divorce court, and that was what they used against me to try to, you know, hurt me or take my children. And do you have any advice about that? How would you deal with something like that?
Well, honestly,
how do you talk to someone?
Yeah, I mean, I have a few different answers, and it's not really in relationship to your experience because yours probably happened a little bit before there was any awareness in the mental health field about any of this, and now there is increasing awareness. So, you know, there are two things. One,
you're breaking up again, Cassie.
Oh, goodness. Well, let's see if I can get closer to
this. Stand
in
that spot. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Is this better for you, too?
Yeah.
Great. So one thing is to ask for help only from people who are skilled in this arena and who have a certain level of spiritual competency. And one way to find those people is to go to the kind of the form of spirituality that you're either engaged in or having the experience of. If you can do a little bit of research, now the internet is such a great tool. So say you're having a Kundalini experience, which now is pretty well known, you know, but at one point was completely obscure, that feeling of that, you know, flow of energy that's coursing through your body, through your spine, and kind of blowing you out a little bit and can be very, very, very uncomfortable. It's great to get in touch with someone who is a yoga practitioner and ask them, who would you recommend as a psychologist or a mental health professional who actually knows something about this? Because if you go to someone who doesn't know anything about it, then they are going to use the old paradigm diagnosis. The other is just to be very discerning about who you talk to, because it's not quite yet safe enough to be completely out of the closet with this stuff. And if you yourself are a professional, you can encounter discrimination. And
it was hard to get a job.
Yeah. So I say, you know, use that discernment, and it's perfectly fine to say my spirituality is very important in my life and guides me to make decisions without having to say I have a spirit guide who guides me. It's not necessary unless it's a safe place.
So do you find that the people have to change their life as to the friends that they've had or the way they live their life, more silent? Because I know noise bothers me a lot now.
Mm.
Did you find that with other people?
Well, I mean, I think I don't know if they have to change their current life, but they certainly often have to add to it. So, you know, I don't think it's necessary that you have to leave current friends and family members unless there's something abusive happening that, you know, this awakens you to that. And then that's not really a spiritual issue, that's just a human issue, and it's the spiritual experience that is awakening you to that reality. But, you know, there are lots of people who are very spiritually oriented and have had a lot of these experiences who have a lot of friends and family members who don't know anything about it. And what's necessary is that they find some people who do know something about it, both peers and people who have been a little bit further down the path who can be trusted guides.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, I don't necessarily mean a guru, though it could be. It's someone who you trust, who you feel like has been around the block a few times in the area that you're just starting in. And that is just priceless, you know, as you're moving through the process. I was talking to a spiritual teacher the other day, and he said, you know, I don't actually tell people what to do. I really just kind of point them when they're going off the path. And we were using the analogy of those guys who guide the airplanes in with the two lights, you know, that's
mm-hmm.
sort of what the guide is doing, is like, okay, come a little bit this way. Oh, no, come a little bit this way. So it's a gentle process.
I guess one thing I wanted to say here is you said something in your book, let me find it here, that silence or the need for silence, people sometimes take that as the person being depressed.
Mm.
When really they seek silence more for some reason, and it doesn't necessarily reflect that they're depressed.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I think that people who are on the path of spiritual development, and it doesn't always look like this. There are some people who are still very rambunctious and rowdy and busy and love to do all that stuff, but overall there's a greater need for silence and solitude, time.
You're breaking up again.
Okay. I will do my best to see if I'm
better
now. As close as I can get, but I'll do my best here.
Okay.
So, you know, while there can be some variations, most of the people we talked about an increasing need for time in nature, for solitude, for silence, and there's just less of an attraction to getting hooked into the drama of life.
Mm-hmm.
There's less capacity or inclination to kind of take things personally and make yourself sort of the protagonist in every story, a little bit more tendency to sit back and let things unfold as they will. Doesn't mean a sense of passivity by any means, because the accompanying quality is that you're able to respond to situations clearly and directly. But you find, I think, that a lot of situations require much less response than most of us whip up, you know? And so there's a little bit more capacity to let things unfold as they will, to go with the flow, and then to choose your battles is one way to say it, you know,
mm-hmm.
to have that energy available to you when it's time to take a stand or respond strongly. You absolutely have that capacity.
Do you find that... I know when I went to my therapist, she kept trying to get me to do what I call psychological digs, you know, talking about all these problems, and I was like, I don't need to talk about them anymore.
Mm.
And so she kept trying to pull that out of me, and I'd like, you know, to let people know that it's okay not to have to do that if you don't feel like you don't need to do it anymore, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it can go either way, that some people derive a great sense of integration by going back and soul retrieving and clearing out emotional trash and finding places where their pain body, as Eckhart Tolle would say, is locked up around an old issue that's no longer even relevant. So that can be extremely helpful for some people. And then for other people, it's time for them to stop telling those stories.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Angela Sarian as one of our interviewees, and I believe she's the person who, and maybe it's David Stendelrest, who both of them have had kind of variations on the theme of if you've told a story more than seven times, it's time to put that story to bed.
Mm-hmm. Does the transformation experience disappear if you don't honor it?
Well, I think there it's a paradox, and I do think that that in one way that's very true, that you can have all kinds of fireworks experiences, and I think so many people have had the experience of having a very clear moment where you say to yourself, there's no way I'll ever be able to fall into that trap again because now I see it for what it really is. Mm-hmm. And by Monday morning, they're right back in it. So that's, I think, what we mean in the book when we say transformation disappears if you don't honor it. On the other hand, there is this thing that you and I were talking about earlier where one of the great analogies we like to use is those magic eye posters that were popular in the 70s and 80s where mm-hmm. it just looks like this blurry sort of pattern, and when you look at it in a particular way, this 3D image pops out of it. And what you find with those is that before you've seen the image, you know, it really, the only reason you'd ever look at it differently is you've got a friend saying, hey, you got to check this out and do it, look at it in this particular way. Once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. And so I think there were several paradoxes in our work that are hard to capture in particularly from a scientific perspective that doesn't want there to be two right answers that are apparently contradictory. But I think everyone on the transformative journey knows that there's a lot of paradox involved. There's things that seem to be equally true. Another one, for example, is, you know, we interviewed a lot of people, and, you know, some of the people would say, the only way you will ever transform is through your own will, intention, and choice. That is the most important thing you can do is choose, set intention, and make the effort every single day to be who you want to be. Just as true, we interviewed lots of people who said the only way to transform is to let go and get out of the way because transformation is just happening, and the more you try to meddle in it and try to control it and bring your will into it, the further off the track you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And those two things are actually really true at the same time, and I think it's a dance between the two.
Mm-hmm. What kind of scientific evidence do you have behind it? Did you do any brain work monitoring or heart monitoring or anything?
Well, in this study, we didn't personally do that, but we do try to review some of the most interesting evidence out there for that is starting to amass to support, for example, the health benefits of spiritual practice. So one area in particular that has recently received a lot of attention is mindfulness practice, mm-hmm. which is a practice that is primarily derived from the Buddhist tradition, but actually contemplative practices appear in most of the world's spiritual traditions.
And what exactly is it?
Mindfulness practice is a process of becoming aware of your thoughts and feelings and sensations in a particular way that is non-judgmental and simply observes them as events that are temporary and come and go. And what it does in some ways is it begins to locate your perspective not from in the middle of your feelings and thoughts and sensations, but from the one who is having those thoughts and feelings and sensations. And the more you practice observing the sensations in your body, the thinking process, the feelings that appear and disappear in your experience, the more you start to say, hey, wait a second, who's watching this? Because if I'm just a combination of thoughts and feelings and sensations, they're coming and going all the time. So who does that make me? Mm-hmm. Well, in what we think is that makes you the one who is aware of all those things. It's the place where they are arising and passing away in. And so that's kind of the esoteric explanation. What they might say from a medical model is that mindfulness is the ability to observe your sensations and thoughts and feelings without judgment so that you get less caught up in them and they stress you out less. And so that's how it's been studied most frequently, is as a stress reduction technique. And it appears to really work for people. And not only does it work in terms of how much stress they report after learning this skill, they're calling it a skill now. It used to be a spiritual practice more, but now it's kind of secularized. But also you see long-lasting changes in the way the brain processes information. for example, you see in people who have received this training, whereas perhaps they used to have a more right hemisphere, right prefrontal hemisphere dominance, they have a more balanced dominance, so that they have a less pessimistic outlook and they have a more sort of balanced way of processing information in the brain. You see effects on the immune system, and there are several studies that are starting to amass that sort of speak to the benefit of that. And then there's a whole other literature around yoga. There's some very interesting literature now coming out about different types of meditation, like a chanting meditation, loving kindness meditations. And so I think that the scientific field is beginning to sort of break down its fear about science being contaminated by religion and, you know, violating the separation of church and state, for example, and starting to say, hey, if people are experiencing health benefits from their spiritual engagement and their spiritual practices, then we need to take a look at what's happening, because that might give us information about the way people can flourish better. And so I'm involved in a study now that arose out of this work that is a $250,000 study funded by the Duke University Center for Spirituality and Theology and Health and the Fetzer Institute, that is going to follow three groups of practitioners over the course of a year to see how their engagement in their spiritual community and their spiritual practice is involved in health and well-being outcomes.
That's wonderful.
Physical, emotional. And so that'll be religious science practitioners, centering prayer practitioners, and a particular type of meditation.
All right. I know you're probably not going to know the answer to this, but I have to ask it just in case you have an idea. You know, when something like this happens, the people that it happens to usually says, oh, our frequency raised. What happens that makes this happen? What is happening? What happens when somebody has an epiphany? Does their overall, maybe their aura or their body or their brain or something start having, you know, shoot up in frequency and hurts literally?
Mm.
What happens?
Well, it's really hard to say at the moment. I mean, I think right now we're just starting to train the lens of neuroscience on some of these experiences. And, for example, some of the first work is looking at people who have been spiritual practitioners for quite a long time, adept meditators, and what they're showing in terms of the word frequency is a more of a gamma EEG signature in their brain, which is really what you'd call sort of an integrative or coherent signal that pulls the different parts of the brain together in sort of a broader way of functioning in the world as opposed to a limited or constricted way. And you know, it's a little speculative at the moment what the gamma signal means, but what we do know is that people who have meditated for years and years have enhanced gamma signals.
Interesting. I've never heard that. So
yeah, it's really good. It's Wolf Singer has some research. Wolf Singer, S-I-N-G-E-R.
Where is he?
He's actually at the Max Planck Institute.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so there are just the beginnings of finding more out about exactly what's happening. And, you know, it's really hard to study epiphany experiences because it's hard to make them happen reliably, like
right,
in a laboratory setting. Having said that, there certainly are programs that are absolutely engineered to cause a transformative experience and that people afterwards say that they were never the same again. And
really?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's programs, you know, that people go to that have been worked for years and years and years to engineer the right conditions for people to really have a transformative moment. And I think those would be really good areas to study, places where you could do brain scans and,
mm-hmm,
you know, assays before people go and then after and then 6 months later to see kind of how long it lasted. And I would be very surprised if there weren't brain changes that accompany the subjective experience of people who really feel like they experienced a transformation.
Mm-hmm. So I did somebody, you know, as people send me books all the time to come on here, and somebody sent me a book the other day, The Spiritual Brain. Have you looked at that book?
I haven't, no.
I can't think of the guy's last name, but if I can remember, I'll email that to you.
Yeah,
it's all
great
about this. It's quite complicated.
Yeah.
I don't get it all, but I'm working on it, but maybe that might be something. But The next question, I know you've been waiting on this question. I think that Noetic Sciences is doing some of the most important work in the world. And I think, you know, that word consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And people listen to you guys, and you know what I think about the definition in this book. I think it's incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish you had given, because I interviewed you, you know, a year or two ago, two or three years ago, and we talked about this word, and you gave me a little bit different definition, and so I want to know, in this book, is this definition of basically it's awareness?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the only definition, or is that just the definition for this book, or do you really think that consciousness is simply awareness?
Well, I don't know if I would say it's awareness. Well, let me put it this way. So, and maybe, you know, it's possible that it could be better outlined in the book this way, but I think what we were saying is that consciousness on a personal level is our awareness of the world as we experience it. And when I say awareness, I don't mean conscious awareness. I mean in the way you experience the world in ways that you're aware of and in ways that you're not aware of. So there's the conscious experience of the world, which is what most reductionists would call consciousness. Then there's the subliminal or unconscious perceptions of the world, which really are more like, you know, account for probably 80 to 90% of our functioning, because we don't think, obviously, about everything we do. We react. We have habit systems. We have implicit filters through which we are seeing our entire world. And what we're saying about transformation is that it's very likely that the world is not, or reality as it is not changing. It's those filters and those perceptions and those ways that we experience the world that's changing. So when we asked our interviewees about the term consciousness transformation, many people said consciousness doesn't transform. The human experience of consciousness transforms.
Yeah, that, I like that better.
Yeah.
The reason that this is important to me, it's like, I get a wild hair up me, you know. But when I've interviewed all these people, these 30 or 40 or 50 people over the past few years, and scientists, Tiller, Wolf, Targ, Radin, Dunn, John, you know, that group of people, and I say, what is consciousness to you? I get 50 different answers.
Yeah, yeah.
So I figure, if we're going to, and Amit Goswami said this, oh my God, Eva, I had no idea that we had this many answers. How is conventional science ever going to listen to us if we keep giving different answers and we don't even know on the same page and we don't know it?
Yeah, well, that's, I think, why they call it the hard question, with a capital H and a capital Q, the hard question of consciousness. And yeah, I mean, I think that would be very interesting and potentially rewarding and maybe foolhardy idea would be to bring people together who are in sort of the field of consciousness studies and say, can we at least agree on what consciousness is? And I have my doubts about whether, especially the group of people that you just listed, could ever come to.
Well, you know, I wrote Marilyn Schlitz about this, and she didn't even bother to answer.
Oh, well,
which
you know,
kind of
yeah. There's like 4,000 emails a month or something that come through that place, so it's probably not personal. But, you know, I think that it's a word that means different things to different people, and that's why we felt driven to define what we were talking about in the book. And what we were talking about was transformation in your consciousness as a reader has more to do with your experience of the world changing than anything else changing.
What I define consciousness is source, you know, the God force, or whatever you want to call that thing.
Yeah, big
C. It's the thing that breathes life and everything. And so I think you do too. No, and when I say you, I mean noetic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would I would go again to say that when we're talking about consciousness transformation, we're really talking about transforming the human experience of consciousness or the individual experience of consciousness. But many of our teachers talk to us about the idea that consciousness is something that is shared by all and, in fact, imbues every molecule of our entire existence, and that we are just kind of tapping into that energy as much as we can, and that's really what transformation is more and more coming into alignment with that ever-present source. But I don't think that's what transforms. I think it's the human,
right.
The way you experience the world transforms.
I just wanted to make sure,
yeah.
Because I'm using these interviews to write a book about that thing. What
oh,
is
good.
It? So I wanted to make sure that the conventional scientists, for Henry Spatt, for example, understood that that's not all you mean consciousness to be, that that's just how you use it in this book, this
yeah.
particular book.
Yeah, yeah. And I think at one point before we were edited so much in the book, we also had a whole piece about Carl Jung in that section
mm-hmm.
that talked about the various levels of consciousness, that there's personal consciousness, there's collective consciousness,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, I think that that's very relevant in this.
Yeah, I do too. Do you think that there are gradients in human consciousness? For it? And what I mean by that is, if somebody that's awake tries to talk to, say, a fundamental Christian, the person that's awake can hear what the Christian has to say and accept it and understand where they're coming from. But the fundamentalist is not going to hear or accept. They're going to still proselytize you and try to get you to convert.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that's a gradient in conscious awareness?
Well, you know, there's the work of Don Beck and Spiral Dynamics and Ken Wilber, who talks about these different levels of consciousness, and that as you proceed through them, you incorporate the one prior, and mm-hmm. that you're, if you're at the one prior, that you can't see the world in a latter stage.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think of things in a much less linear fashion. I do think it's incredibly difficult to speak to someone who has a very restricted, narrow view of the world when you're someone who is trying to, you know, who's got a larger view. But at the same time, I think that we all, number one, we're those people, it's a mistake to make them other. And so finding the point of connection in some ways would be the responsibility of the person who, if you want to put a linear way of looking at it on it, would be the responsibility of the person who's more evolved.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And one of the great ways of doing that, actually, is just to ask questions. And this is not a trick. It's not a leading question. It's literally to ask questions. And so a great example that I think has been inspiring to me over the last few months is I heard a surgeon who was on a radio show, and he's written a book called The Scalpel and the Soul. Have you heard of this?
No, but I'm going to write it down.
Yeah,
right,
it's really good. So it's a surgeon who was in his residency training, and he was completely a materialist. You know, he had no interest in any kind of religion or, you know, woo-woo weirdness.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a patient. He had a rotation at the pediatric burn ward, and there was a young boy who had been burned over much of his body, and he was rejecting every skin graft that came along. And it was a very, very difficult place to work, obviously. And he mm-hmm. said, you know, what I tried to do is shut myself down as much as possible. And so the boy's father died, just to add insult to injury, in the middle of all of this, I think of a car accident or a heart attack or something. And so they decided to use the father's skin to graft. And the next day after the operation, the nurse came into the doctor's office and said, he's trying to say something. And he said, well, that's impossible. He's far from being able to speak. And she said, no, he is. So he ran in there, and the kid was trying to pull out the tube, so he pulled it out, and the kid looked at him and said, what happened to my father? And he said, you know, being inexperienced and kind of trying to numb out, he just said, I can't tell this boy that his father died after all this. He just said, you know, no, he's fine. You know, nothing happened to your father. And the boy looked at him and said, no, what happened to my father? And he said, okay, well, your father died. And he said, oh, well, that's why he's standing at the end of my bed then.
Oh, my goodness.
And so the doctor has written this book and, you know, has really explored this whole world, and he says, you know, he's got colleagues who come to him and say, you know, are you crazy? What are you doing? You're making us all look like idiots, you know. And he just asks the person, have you ever had, you know, like, I'm not going to tell anyone, but have you ever had an experience that you couldn't explain? And it often just opens up a whole story from each person, and he's not trying to convert them. He's not going to say, oh my gosh, there's an afterlife, or, you know, any of that stuff. He's
mm-hmm.
just asking questions. And so I think going out into the world armed with good questions is one way to, because again, we don't want to fall back into the same mistakes that people have made in the past. We're not missionaries. We don't want to go out converting people to, you know, the dogma of consciousness, right?
Yeah.
But what we do want to do is help people feel safe enough to open their minds. And so I find that approaching people with deep curiosity and a real intent to listen, just asking them, what's the most important thing to you in life? And they answer the question, and it, just that interaction is an opening.
I agree. All right, we got 3 or 4 minutes left, so take this time to tell where people can find you.
Yeah, so
you know,
let me say
book,
that...
a little bit about Noetic.
Yeah, so the name of the book, again, is Living Deeply, The Art and Science of Transformation, and it's available on Barnes & Noble and Amazon. There's also a website that is www.livingdeeply.org, and on the website there's more information about the book and the study and a chat room, and there's an e-learning course where you can go on and take a little self-directed course online. There's an accompanying DVD that is called Living Deeply, Transformative Practices from the World's Wisdom Traditions, and that has 9, about 10-minute
practices. You're breaking up again.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
So the DVD has 9 practices that are about 10 minutes each, and they are from a variety of the traditions that we interviewed, including Buddhism and Christianity and Islam.
You're breaking up really badly.
Oh, let's see if I can get this. Is this better now?
Yes.
Okay, so the DVD provides these 9 experiential guided practices that are about 10 minutes each, and so it's a great companion to the book because whereas in the book we were looking for commonalities among traditions, this gives you a flavor of the unique contributions of the diverse traditions. We also have upcoming events in Chicago this coming weekend. There's a Living Deeply workshop. There are several other Living Deeply workshops that you can find out about at livingdeeply.org. And the Institute of Noetic Sciences is at www.noetic.org. And there's also a big conference for IONS coming up next summer in June 16th through 21st in Tucson. And so that's a great place if you're looking for connection in any of the kinds of topics that we just covered in the last hour. That's a wonderful place to go learn more and meet like-minded people.
I can't suggest it strongly enough. Join Noetic. Support them. They're doing very important work, and it's not very much money. You get a great little magazine when you join. Isn't it quarterly?
Yeah, you get a quarterly magazine, and we have our Shift in Action program also where you can pay $10 a month and have access to live teleseminars, 2 live teleseminars every week. One of them is a Living Deeply channel. And you get access to thousands of hours of downloads of some of the great thought leaders in the area of consciousness studies. And so that's a real bargain, I think.
Well, thanks for coming on, Cassie.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
Yeah, that was great. The time passed so quickly.
I figured you were dreading that question.
No, not at all. I think it's great. Yeah.
But thanks a lot, and I hope you'll come back sometime.
Okay, thank you.
Good night.
Good night.